In Othello, Desdemona talks about Othello's adventures. Do you remember what they are? What she says?
No. We're just, like, we're in Shakespeare class together. You always, like, bring up the play that we're
reading. Yeah, like, the play that we were talking about.
Like, we're reading Othello right now. We talked about Hamlet a lot while we're reading Hamlet.
Uh-huh.
That always matches up.
Yeah,
so this is not planned.
Oh, really? Well, crossover, you know, like.
No, it can happen. Quinny and I sometimes do crossovers like that, but Targoff and I have not.
Okay.
You drop Easter eggs for the tiny middle of your Venn diagram circle of students who are in both your courses.
that's the main thing that's pushing what I'm teaching. Yeah.
That's the motivation.
Yeah. So. How many people are in Orgo? Because I was going to talk about some organic chemistry metaphors. Who are you pointing to?
No, next year.
Oh, okay, next year. Okay, so take a course with me next year. And we'll be talking about carbon and nitrogen and oxygen and hydrogen and how weird they are. Actually, there was a... Has anyone taken the tree class with Perlman?
Uh-huh.
So, did you like it? Okay, all right. Remember, this is being recorded. So Jane, you didn't like it, huh, Jane Humboldt? Well, I hope he doesn't hear that. Okay, it's totally fine. But there was an article that I just saw today, which I actually told him about to his surprise, that it turns out that trees were as bad for the world and for the environment as we are, which this is a newly discovered thing, that when trees started growing, they started just, their roots went deep and deep and deep and got all these phosphates out of the soil. And then the trees died and all the phosphates leaked into the ocean and caused an extinction of 60% of different species in the ocean because of all these phosphates and the algae that bloomed from them. So if you were in that class, that would be the Venn diagram. But just tell you, you know, trees, we kind of think of them as nice, but maybe some tree, you know, like they might have, like, you might be of three minds about trees. Like a tree in which there are
three blackbirds.
Yeah, good. Okay. So it may make you of three minds about trees. Trees are actually, I think, the most dangerous thing that grows. I think more people are killed by trees than any other plant in the U.S. each year. Because they fall. Yeah, it snows, a branch hits you, you die. So just so you know. So they do more good than harm, but they did do a lot of harm in the past. All right. But the only emperor is the emperor of ice cream. So let's go back to that. Essentially where we got to, what we're going to do is talk about a few more metaphorical poems now. Oh, yeah, I think I gave you the bad copy of Burned, which I didn't get the carriage returns in, but you've already read it. Some of you heard it twice. Some of you were kind enough to talk about how well Stallings read it. Just how powerful it was when you heard it in the poet's voice. So that's great. That made me so happy. No, it did. But we're going to talk a little bit more about metaphor. And then we're going to move on. We're still talking about different forms of poetry. And we've talked about the villanelle. We're going to talk about a couple of other forms. And we're going to talk about... This is kind of what we'll... pretty much what we'll be talking about for the remainder of the class, are also the way some poems are attempting to rewrite other poems. And one thing that you have to do if you're rewriting another poem is give somewhere some indication of what poem it is that you're rewriting. And that indication can be subtle, and sometimes it can be argued, but it's actually kind of neat when you see that one poem is rewriting another. Just to take an example where the fact that it's a revision isn't that subtle. If you look, turn to the other side of the page, not the Wallace Stevens side, but the one on the left, there's the Rowan Ricardo Phillips poem. So he entitles that poem, "Never Again Would Bird Song Be the Same." And one way, maybe subtle, one way you could see that he is rewriting a Robert Frost poem is how?
The title.
It's the exact same title. So he takes the title of a very famous Robert Frost poem, and he rewrites the poem. And a question that you would always ask is, why do poets do that? And again, the answer is that all poems are about themselves, and therefore, to some extent, about the poems that they are saying are maybe coming into their true self in the revision, or maybe that the revision is explicitly criticizing, is explicitly saying that the earlier poem got it wrong, or maybe that the earlier poem is only a subset of the truth that the later poem is telling. There are lots of reasons to do it, and that's something that we will be talking about more as the class winds down or winds up. It becomes an interesting issue. And one way that all poems, you could say, are all, I'm going to say all poems. You shouldn't be hesitant to make grand claims in this class. Like, all poems are about themselves. All poems are about love and fear of death. There are things you can say that on some level are bound to be true. All metaphors are cries in the wilderness. That's a metaphor. One thing you could say is that any poet who writes in a recognized form is revising, rewriting, claiming that this form would come into its own in the poem now being written. So if you write a villanelle like "You Cannot Unburn What Is Burned," the villanelle called Burned, in a way, now she would never accept this phrase, I don't think, but in a way what she's doing is a, wait for it, sick burn on previous villanelles. Here, you should be laughing. Yeah, good, right? Which is, in a sense, what she's saying is she is going to use a different idea and say that even though, so we didn't really talk about this part of it, but even though villanelles are always returning to their opening first and third line, that return is never going to be a true return. So, as she says at the end, it's time you learned that even if you had returned, you'd only be a kind of ghost. You can't go back. It's time you learned that what is burned is burned is burned. So the form is one which tries to go back, to say, do not go gentle into that good night, rage, rage against the dying of the light. But she's saying you can't go back. Even from the beginning to the end of the poem, you can't go back to the beginning of the poem. So writing in a form is always a comment on the form that you're writing in. That's how poems are about themselves. It's always a comment about the poem that you're writing in. And, I mean, about the form that you're writing in. And the form itself is a kind of archaeological or geological record of all the poems that have been written in that form in the past. So if you write a sonnet, it's going to, from the beginning, seem like a gesture towards a love poem. So if a sonnet is a love poem, that makes perfect sense because sonnets are, because so many sonnets are, because of who sonnets to whom? Originally, the inventor of the sonnet? It's time you learned. Just quoting Alicia Stallings. Petrarch, sonnets to Laura. Remember? Translated by whom? The long love that in my thought doth harbor, and in my heart doth make his residence. What does that love do? Into my face. Just paraphrase.
That poem?
Just the next line.
Oh.
So love harbors in my thoughts and makes his residence in my heart and then does what into my face?
Makes your face red.
Yeah, okay. Into my face presseth with bold pretense mm-hmm. and there him bideth setting his banner. Mm-hmm. So that's Wyatt translating Petrarch. Then you get Surrey, who was also a translator of Petrarch, who writes, love that doth live and reign within my thought. And one of the things that he's doing, you could say, is correcting the earlier translation, saying, this is how Wyatt translated it, but I'm going to give you a more accurate translation. So now what we have is Wyatt taking a form invented in Italy, saying it's a love poem, taking that form invented in Italy as a love poem, writing a love poem in English, which is a translation but also a transfiguration of the original. And then you have Surrey, who was a younger friend of Wyatt's, who is saying, no, here's a more accurate translation. So three sonnets, and they're all in a kind of relation to each other and in a kind of tension with each other. Surrey wrote a great elegy when Wyatt died, which begins with the wonderful line, Wyatt resteth here. So where would you say someone rests here? Where would you find that? Gravestone. So the elegy is kind of pretending to be a verse on a gravestone. Wyatt resteth here, who quick could never rest. So what does quick mean there? Sorry?
Like busy?
No. If you cut someone to the quick, do you know what that means? It's a metaphor. All right, quick means alive. It's a word that you will find in, oh, I don't know, Shakespeare. And it means alive. To cut someone to the quick is to, it's if you were to cut a tree to the xylem, if you were to cut a plant to where it is taking in nutrients up its stem, that's cutting it to the quick. So quick there means the source of life, but to be quick means to be alive. That's an old meaning of the word quick. So what Surrey is punning on is two ideas of quick. One, Wyatt resteth here, who quick, when he was alive, could never rest, but that's also because he was so quick. So fast, bouncing all over the place. So they are in a really interesting relation to each other. One of the poems in Tottle's Miscellany, people remember what that is?
Didn't he like translate a bunch of poems or whatever?
He published a bunch of poems written by Wyatt and Surrey and some other poets. And Shakespeare mentions that book twice in his plays, including the gravedigger in Hamlet. Okay, good. who sings a parody of a song. Well, anyone see the Weird Al movie? You should watch it. It's great. It's on Hulu. It's free. The Weird Al Yankovic story, starring Daniel Radcliffe, if that helps, and with a cast of amazing guest stars. At any rate, parody is a version of talking about an earlier poem. It's the strongest version. So do people know who Weird Al is? Okay, so what he's doing is he's parodying songs. One of the things he complains about in the movie is he complains that Michael Jackson is actually parodying his song, Eat It. So do people know about this? There's a song where Weird Al is singing Eat It, Eat It. And it's his parody of Beat It. But in the movie, he claims Michael Jackson is actually writing a parody of his song, Eat It, and that Michael Jackson's parody is the song called Beat It. The parody is the strongest and most obvious version of redoing an earlier poem. In the case of parody, it's to redo it, maybe to diss it, maybe to admire it, but from a kind of skewed and quirky point of view. But parody is that kind of revision. But any new poem in a known form is going to be a revision of that poems written in that form. And sometimes you can look at poems that are particular revisions of earlier poems, as in Never Again Would Birdsong Be the Same, the Phillips version, versus the Frost version. So we will be looking at some of those later on, but it's one place where things are coming together. A lot of the issues we've been talking about are coming together. Sometimes the metaphors will be the same. There's a poem that people used to have to memorize in elementary school by the early 19th century poem Felicia Hemans, H-E-M-A-N-S, called Casabianca. And it's a poem about what happens in that poem. Ask your great-grandparents, and they'll tell you about how they had to memorize this poem. What happens in that poem is it tells of an incident in the Peninsular War between France and England, where a father is the captain of a boat, and he tells his son, no matter what happens, don't leave the ship, and then until I give you the order to do so. And then the father is killed, and the ship is sinking, and the son never gets the order to abandon ship, so he doesn't. And so it's, you know, heartwarming, sad, tragic story about this little boy's bravery. And it begins, the boy stood on the burning deck whence all but he had fled. So it's a poem people had to memorize about this boy standing on the burning deck as the ship is burning up, whence all but he had fled. And then Bishop writes a poem 150 years later, also called Casabianca, which begins with a metaphor. Loves the boy stood on the burning deck, trying to recite the boy stood on the burning deck. So now she has a poem, same title, in which an allegorical or metaphorical figure of love loves the boy stood on the burning deck. That allegorical or metaphorical figure of love is trying to recite the earlier poem. Or remember the Space Saver sonnet by Starbuck? To think, loo, dink, and miss, landis, dead. You do steady me. So 14 lines, 14 syllables. And how that's a revision of a Shakespeare sonnet with 14 lines and 140 syllables. So poems, by the very fact that they're poems, are always in some relationship to any other poem written in that form. And if you say, yeah, well, what about free verse? Even more so because they're in relationship to the first poems written in free verse. Paul Valéry gave a lecture in the 1930s where he said, I have astonishing news. You won't believe what I'm about to tell you. People are writing poems not according to the rules. They're writing in free verse. And everyone knew that by then. But the point is, if you write in free verse, you are inheriting a tradition of a refusal to write in form or an indifference to form. So free verse is itself a form. It has to be. So we'll be looking at very specific examples of that. But let's go back now just to talk about metaphor a bit more. So we're looking at the emperor of ice cream. Call, just to have it again in our minds, in our heads, call the roller of big cigars, the muscular one, and bid him whip in kitchen cups concupiscent curds. So cigars, remember, are a phallic symbol. And the roller of big cigars is a person who is really strong from all the cigar rolling that he has done. Now the speaker of this poem is saying he should be making ice cream. So bid him whip in kitchen cups concupiscent curds. And recall the concupiscent means of or having to do with lust, let's say. That would be a good definition of it. So concupiscent curds, if he is going to whip them into kitchen cups, the concupiscent curds. Yeah, so he's making ice cream. He's just whipping the cream. But you can see how quickly that could become a funny way of describing certain male activities. So bid him whip in kitchen cups, concupiscent curds. Let the wenches dawdle in such dresses they are used to wear, and let the boys bring flowers in last month's newspapers. Let be finale of seem. The only emperor is the emperor of ice cream. So, summer day is what he's evoking here, summer days. You can tell that the roller of big cigars is muscular. Why? What image do you have? An image, yeah, go ahead.
It says the muscular one.
Yeah, but, yes. We know he's muscular because the lines say that he's muscular. But what is your image of a muscular roller of big cigars if you were to draw a picture of him? Just without any of this, the sexual hinting here. If you were just to draw a picture of a muscular roller of big cigars, what would you be drawing? I think this is an easy question.
Uh-huh. Broad shoulders.
Yeah, okay, and how could you tell his arms were big? Vivi says he'd have big arms and broad shoulders. Sorry, Vivi, go ahead.
Like, if his arms are big, like, you can physically see it. Like, especially, like, if he's rolling cigars, like, the muscles will bulge when he does it.
Okay, so what would he be wearing?
A tank top.
A tank top. Yeah, a muscle shirt. You'd be able to see his muscles as he's rolling the cigars. So what season would it be? Summer. So this is, look, just how quickly, it's almost, I think you all knew that, but you didn't even realize you knew it, that this is an image from summer, that it's hot. He's rolling the big cigars, and that makes sense that this is a poem about ice cream, because it's summer and it's hot. So let the boys bring flowers in last month's newspapers. Let the wenches dawdle in such dresses that you're used to wear. It's summertime. It's flowers. It's newspapers. It's the living is easy. And he is whipping into kitchen cups for people to have ice cream, the concupiscent curds. And then let be finale of seem. That's a maybe harder line. But what do you think it means, anyone? Let be finale of seem. Yeah,
most
Elijah.
Seasons are trending towards like the growth that is fully developed in summer. It is the like culmination of the seasons developing. Everything's in full bloom.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so if B is, remember, where is this line from? I think I'm depressing myself by asking you to remember stuff that we've gone over. But, 'tis not alone, no harshness gives offense. The sound... must blank... the echo of the sense. So remember sound and sense? If Ajax drives from rocks vast weight to throw, the line two labors and the verse moves slow. Not so when swift Camilla scours the plain, flies o'er the unbending corn and skims along the main. Do you remember this? Or it was like, okay, done that. Now I can free up some disk space in my head. Okay, so 'tis not enough, no harshness gives offense. The sound. So do you remember who wrote that?
Alexander Pope,
okay. Yeah, because remember the needless Alexandrine, which is how he sometimes felt, like he was needless. So what he's saying there is that sound should go with sense. They should harmonize. The sound of a line, remember, soft is the strain when Zephyr gently blows. So the sound should always be harmonizing with the sense. And he says, 'tis not alone, no harshness give offense. 'Tis not enough, no harshness give offense. The sound must something, the echo of the sense. The sound must seem, yes, good. And what people always remember it as, and I'm sure that's why you were hesitant because you weren't sure that this was right, and it wouldn't have been, the sound must be an echo of the sense. So it's frequently remembered. If you were to Google, which don't do now because we're in class, but if you, I know you're eager to because, you know, Pope and poetry, but if you were Google, the sound must be an echo of the sense, you would get a huge number of hits, even though that's incorrect. It's the sound must seem an echo of the sense. And we talked about that as kind of self-proving, that the word seem works so well that we think, yes, the sound actually is an echo of the sense. And that's how people remember that line. So 'tis not enough, no harshness give offense. The sound must seem and echo to the sense. So that's what Stevens is kind of saying here. Let B be finale of seem. Let the culmination of things seeming to be a certain way be that they are that way. Let B be finale of seem. What biologically does concupiscence cause in the world? The fact that people want to have sex. I think you learned this in middle school.
Babies?
Yes! Good! Babies! Yeah. So, it is because of desire, because of concupiscence, because of lust, that there are babies in the world. And so what happens is, you could say, that seeming turns into being without even dreaming that there's any pun on seem, in seem, because you wouldn't want to dream that. But that seeming turns into being, which would mean... How might you paraphrase that?
Like, possibility turns into actuality.
Okay, so possibility in a sexual context means what? Just consider your own adolescence. What does possibility mean?
Virginity.
Okay, virginity means it's only possibility. But what about just plain old possibility? It means fantasy. So seeming is a fantasy, right? Thinking about it, imagining it. And then if B is the finality of seem, what happens? It turns into reality. And what is the result 9 months later? The 9 months there is a hint. What is the result 9 months later? Yes, a brand new being. So B is the finale of seem. Because the only emperor is the emperor of ice cream, which would mean the instinct that rules us, the most important instinct in human character, is the instinct for what?
Making new life.
For engaging in the activity that would make a new life. How would that be? It's not like, oh, no, sex sounds so boring. I agree, it sounds so boring. Yeah, but we have a duty to make a new life. Yeah, we'll just have to hold our nose, Netflix and hold our nose. Okay, so this is essentially the roller of the big cigars is offering something pleasant, ice cream. But that pleasantness is even better than ice cream, or more pleasant than ice cream. So it's sexuality. So there is the feeling of desire, the feeling of pleasure, the feeling of things are pleasant, and they could be even more pleasant. Frank O'Hara has a great line about, it's actually in the great poem called Mothers of America, whose first line is, "Mothers of America, let your kids go to the movies." And it's about how great movies are. And at the end, he talks about how your kid might go off with some pleasant stranger to the Heaven on Earth building down in Lower Brooklyn. So it's pleasant. Ice cream is pleasant, and that pleasantness can get more and more intensified. So we have this depiction of a pleasant experience, eating ice cream, going out for an ice cream soda, let's say. The roller of the big cigars is also making ice cream. That's nice. And finally, this will culminate in the existence of a new being. And then, yeah, the only emperor is the emperor of ice cream. That is, it is what Freud calls the pleasure principle. The desire for pleasure, says Freud, drives all human activity. Now, that may sound a little reductive, but Freud is the last person in the world to be reductive. What he means by pleasure is something really complicated. But nevertheless, the desire for pleasure is what drives human activity. It is, as Samuel Beckett puts it in his summary of what human life is, he has a character who talks about living, and he says, to live. And then he explains what that verb means, to live, to love. Here are the three infinitives that to live summarizes: to love, to eat, to escape the redressers of wrongs. So what it means to live is, well, to love, ultimately to have sex, to have desire, to have companionship, to eat, because you certainly need to do that, and to avoid those who want to get back at you for the wrong you've done to them, as though wrong is inevitable. So that's a typical Beckett line. To live, dash, to love, to eat, to escape the redressers of wrongs. But all of those are meant to maximize pleasure and to minimize unpleasure, to use Freud's word, unpleasure. So, yeah, ice cream here is standing for pleasure, and it's pleasure that is what drives us to live as we do and drives us to reproduce and to overpopulate the world. So that as of today, you know how many people there are in the world as of today?
8 billion.
8 billion. So today's the day that the odometer clicked over. 8 billion people in the naked world. So the only emperor is the emperor of ice cream. The roller of the big cigars, you know, he's a big guy, but he's saying, yeah, ice cream is good. So the roller of the big cigars who's saying, here, have some ice cream. It's okay. B will be the finale of seem. What is the most famous sentence in all of writing that begins with the word let? Say it again. I can't hear you. Let there be light. Yes. So let B be finale of seem. Think about it. That's kind of like let there be light. That is, seeming is projection, is seeing something. Seem is actually, I learned this when I was in seventh grade and I thought it was bullshit, but the more you think about it, the truer it is. Seem is the passive of see. So if something is seen as or in a certain way, then it seems to be the thing that it's seen as. So let B be finale of seem is let there be light. Light shows how things seem, but the light itself turns into something that bees, to use bad English, something that is. Let B be finale of seem. So who's the roller of big cigars in that case? Who's established things?
God.
Yeah. Who else would it be? It's either God or biology or evolution. But the roller of big cigars is the one who makes sexual desire the thing that runs the biological world. Okay? So it's not that the roller of big cigars is some guy jerking off. He is some god making, creating sexuality, creating the very idea of sex, embodying it, but also creating it. After all, he's the roller of the cigars. He's the one creating the cigars by rolling them. So all of those images, do you see how they're all kind of overlapping and merging and coming together here to finally be about the creation of new beings? So the only emperor is the emperor of ice cream would then mean the only god is
God.
The god of sex, lust, desire, and their consequences. Okay? A lot of people don't know that the chill in Netflix and Chill is a reference to this poem. It's because of ice cream that it's called Netflix and Chill. Many people don't know that, so now you know something that very few people in the world know. But it's cool, so to speak. All right. So the only emperor is the emperor of the blind pursuit of pleasure, which leads to biological reproduction. And so the metaphor, the image is, you know, going to the soda shop on a summer day, having some ice cream and having a good time. It's all very pleasant. Dawdling around, wearing a dress that is light and pleasant. Boys are bringing flowers in last month's newspapers. They're not, rich people, but they're having fun on a summer's day. If you all ever read Nancy, the cartoon Nancy, it's like classic Nancy. And if you don't, you should. Olivia James does it now, and she's totally wonderful, but not like the classic version. But I think if you don't know who Nancy and Sluggo are, if you Google them, you'll recognize them. It's that kind of world. It's a world of 50s TV, let's say, of 40s or 30s movies or comic strips. So the Emperor of Ice Cream says, be fruitful and multiply. Let there be light. Let be finale of seem. Be fruitful and multiply. And the Emperor of Ice Cream makes sure that you're fruitful and multiplying by offering you ice cream. Because who says no to ice cream? That's the basic idea. So the only emperor is the emperor of a blind pursuit of sexual pleasure, which leads to more people, leads to 8 billion people in the world. Okay, so is this English teacher overreading, or is this... No, it's okay if you think it is, but I want to convince you that it isn't. So Judy, what do you think, since you were laughing nervously?
I think it isn't.
All right.
It makes sense.
Okay, good. What do other people think?
I think it isn't. I just think it's like a weird metaphor to make. Like, just the idea of this, you know, you read the title and you're like, oh, it's a silly poem about ice cream. And then you look at it deeper and it's just something completely, sort of like the opposite of that.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it does make sense because sort of like... the ice cream on a nice hot summer's day, like that, isn't that like the ultimate pleasure of any child?
Yeah.
Just being able to enjoy that day and sort of how that parallels what adults sort of want in life.
Yeah. Yeah. So if you think about it, it's there's almost a standard way of dealing with existential fears, which we all experience. And the standard way is to live in the moment, to do something fun that isn't that meaningful. You know, it's like, I have these terrible existential fears. When I have fears that I might cease to be, to quote a line of Keats, fears that everyone has. But then someone says, no, look, let's just, let's go get a soda. And that would be fun. And so what you do is you just focus on the moment. You focus on something fun you could do. And it's just great how life is filled with fun. And that can be a helpful thing to remember, to remind yourself of, to experience. Does anyone know about the movie My Dinner with Andre? So in My Dinner with Andre, there is a kind of argument where Andre is all big and brooding and existential. And then his friend, Wallace Shawn, is talking about how he's done all this, had all these mystical experiences, and you know, he's just like over the top. You might call him pompous. And then there's his friend Wallace Shawn, who's just overwhelmed by Andre. Andre Gregory, he was a stage director. And then he starts talking about, you know, just how much fun it is to have some coffee in the morning, and sometimes there's a cockroach there and he's not happy about that, but whatever, it's just a cockroach. Or to quote another wonderful Frank O'Hara poem that ends, oh God, it's just so wonderful to get out of bed and to drink too much coffee and smoke too many cigarettes and love you so much. So just that, you know, life is going to crush you and time is short. Remember the poem that we did, swiftly the years beyond recall, but then how long this spring morning is. So go to the local. If I can give you one piece of advice for how to survive life, it's get to the local. Go enjoy this afternoon. Don't worry about the crushing burden of years and the infinity of nothingness that awaits you. But have some ice cream. That'll cheer you up a lot. So that is what it would mean to drink too much coffee and smoke too many cigarettes and love you so much. Yeah.
This might be sort of splitting hairs, but there's something sort of weird about the way that this reading sets up the analogy with ice cream, because presumably on this reading, the ice cream is the object of desire itself, right? It's the thing that you want. But if we're talking about sort of like the motivations that about like sexuality, it seems like sex is not the object of the desire, right? Like what's relevant there is not the thing being desired, but the sort of internal desiring.
Yeah.
Right? It seems like what would be analogous is not the emperor of ice cream, but like the emperor of craving ice cream.
Yeah.
And those are different things. It's weird that the emphasis is placed on the object, not the
subject. It's the emperor of ice cream who makes you crave ice cream. Because he's God.
Yeah, but he does it not through ice cream, but through facts about you, right? These are facts about like the subjects who crave ice cream, not about the object of ice cream.
Yeah, but he creates... those are really good questions. But what I would say is he creates something that you desire. And the thing that you desire is described here in metaphors that Beavis and Butthead would quickly see are sexual. So everyone knows Beavis and Butthead. They're back now. Did you know them before they came back? Okay, so they're sexual. It's like ice cream. Uh-huh, sure. So it is that there is this thing which is pleasure. And it's pleasure that, to use another term that I wasn't going to get into in this class, but that metonymically is related to semen. That is that the metonymically means not that it's a metaphor for, but that it kind of hooks up to similar enough idea. So there is this, it's hard once you understand what's going on in the poem to keep semen out of your mind when he whips into kitchen, cups the concupiscent curds. So it's not quite that ice cream is a metaphor for semen, but it's connected in a different way. Some people think of metaphor as vertical. Here. Some people think of metaphor as vertical. That is that something is corresponding with something on a different line. Metonymy is horizontal. Something reminds you of something else through a chain of ideas, even though the connection between them isn't in some way in which every feature of the first is also a feature of the second. So again, the idea is the emperor of ice cream is the emperor of sexuality, let's say. And that's because as God, what he has said is be fruitful and multiply, let every living thing bring forth other things of its kind, and so on. Let's set up a world in which there are these pleasant activities where people get ice cream and together, the wenches and the boys. Wenches here isn't a term that's dissing women. It's just talking about young women and the boys, young men. And, you know, they'll date and they'll have fun and it won't be a big deal and it'll be like, you know, Grease, the musical. And the result of this is 8 billion people. And that is because that's how God sets things up. And so B is the finale of seem. It's just pleasant local experience that turns into the creation of new beings. So, which is not to dismiss what you're saying. I'm just saying that there's just a whole complex array of things at play here. So now we get to the second stanza. Take from the dresser of deal. So do people know what deal is?
Couldn't you say it was like wood?
Yeah, it's a cheap wood. It's the kind of thing that you would get if you were buying furniture at a Goodwill, or the kind of thing you'll find in your rooms here at Brandeis. Take from the dresser of deal, lacking the three glass knobs, So why, just without getting deeply into symbolism of any sort, why is, what does it mean? What's the picture that you have that it lacks the three glass knobs?
There's knob holes for this dresser, but there's no knobs on them anymore.
Yeah, and what does that mean about how rich the owner of the dresser is?
Yeah.
Poor, yeah, it's decrepit. So now we have this deal dresser. It lacks the three glass knobs. Take out of it that sheet on which she embroidered fantails once. So we already talked about this. We know who the she is going to be. It's going to be the dead woman. But once upon a time, she was doing this local decorative thing, embroidering fantails on a sheet. And now that very sheet is in the dresser. She embroidered fantails once upon it. Let me just ask you a question to which the answer is yes. Is the word dresser there somehow picking up on the word dress in the first stanza? Let the wenches dawdle in such dress as they used to wear.
Why?
Why is it picking up on it?
Yeah.
Okay, so you agree it is. Good. That's really smart of all of you. Because there, it's as though the second stanza, which is entirely different, it's not about ice cream shops and pleasant times and people learning about desire and sex. It's about death. And yet their filiations, embroideries? Yeah.
Well, it's kind of calling to, like, this, like, dead woman who's once one of those, like, young wenches.
Yeah. Right, exactly. So on which she embroidered fantails once and spread it so as to cover her face. If her horny feet protrude, they come to show how cold she is and dumb. So her feet are protruding to show how cold she is and dumb. First and only rhyme in the poem, except for the couplets at the end of each stanza. And yeah, her feet are protruding. She's old. Her feet are horny, as we said last time. And if you were to touch them, you would see how cold they were. So she is cold and dumb. She can no longer speak because she's dead. It's the silence of the dead. So if her horny feet protrude, they come to show how cold she is and dumb. Let the lamp affix its beam. So what time of day?
Night.
Yeah, so the first stanza is obviously day. But now it's night. Let the lamp affix its beam. What's the word beam doing here? Obviously, it's a beam of light. Let there be
light.
Light. So going back to that idea, what's it doing sound-wise?
Oh, it's rhyming with seam.
It's rhyming with seam, yeah. And what was the line? Okay, so do you all know what portmanteau words are?
Like a play on words or whatever.
So they're, yeah.
Aren't they the, I'm not sure I'm right, aren't they the direction you read it in?
No, those are palindromes, like race car. So portmanteau words, do people know Jabberwocky? Do you know what it is?
The dances?
No, it's originally from Alice in Wonderland. It's a poem.
Oh.
No?
No, I just know a dance team called
that. Okay, but it's based on Lewis Carroll.
Oh.
So in Lewis Carroll, it's "'Twas brillig, and the slithy toves did gyre and gimble in the waves. All mimsy were the borogroves and the mome wrath outgrabe." Not familiar to people? "Beware the Jabberwock, my son, the claws that bite, the jaws that bite, the claws that catch. Beware the Jubjub bird and shun the frumious Bandersnatch. He took his vorpal sword in hand, Long time the man's own foe he sought, then rested he by the tum-tum tree and stood a while in thought. And as in uffish thought he stood, the Jabberwock with eyes of flame came whiffing through the tulgey wood and gurgled as it came, actually. One, two, and through the vorpal sword went snicker-snack. He left it dead, and with its head he went glumping back. And hast thou slain the Jabberwock? Come to my arms, my beamish boy. Hang on to that word, beamish. Oh, frabjous day, Kaloo Kalay, he chortled in his joy. 'Twas Brillig and the slithy toves did gyre and gimble in the wabe, all mimsy were the bar groves and the moam wrath out. Great. So you never heard that?
No.
Okay, most famous nonsense poem in English. So you should know it, Lewis Carroll. And what seems nonsensical about it?
Half the words are very silly.
Yep. And they're just made up words.
Oh.
They're not real words. So do you know the word chortle?
It's like a laugh almost, right?
Uh-huh. It's like a laugh. It's actually, that poem is the origin of the word chortle. Oh, frabjous day, Kaloo Kalay, he chortled in his joy. So we all know what chortle means, but it's a word that Lewis Carroll made up. If you look it up, you will see, as I just did, chortle, origin, English, through the looking glass, not Alice in Wonderland, through the looking glass. 1871, coined by Lewis Carroll in Through the Looking Glass, a blend of chuckle and snort. So you're chuckling and snorting simultaneously. That's to chortle. So he has combined those two words, and that combination. Yes. All right. Go. Yeah. Just rush forward. Thank you. I'm chortling in my joy at the fact that you're going that fast. Notice that this is what's called, you should just know this term, it's called a portmanteau word. A portmanteau is like a movable dresser. It's what you pack your clothes in when you're about to go on an ocean voyage. And what it means is a coat, literally means a coat carrier, but it's where you put all your clothes. You can pack them, they'll take a lot of clothes, and you can take it with you. So Carol calls this a portmanteau word when the poem is being explained, which is that words that are stuck together into a single word. So a portmanteau word is a word like chortle, where two other words are combined into a single word. So yes, say it again.
E and
yeah, so let B be finale of seem. Now the lamp will affix its beam, which is a kind of combination of be and seem, but maybe going the other way, that if be is the finale of seem, then seeming will lead to being. Here in that very word, beam turns into seem. Remember in Carol, it's come to my arms, my beam-ish boy. So, which is also a portmanteau word, beamish. So here, it's as though whatever is happening in the first stanza is being reversed. What's the most obvious reversal in the second stanza from the first?
Death
instead of life. So the first stanza is about life, reproduction, desire, sexual desire, and to quote Freud, all the mischief that it causes. Freud has a great phrase, Eros, the mischief maker. And the second stanza is about death. Here is this old woman who used to wear the dresses that they used to wear and embroidered fantails. And now she's dead. And now it's night. Hence the lamp affixing its beam, and her horny feet show how cold she is and dumb, how she can't speak because she's dead. Let the lamp affix its beam. And then the moral of this is the only emperor is the emperor of ice cream. So what does that mean in the second stanza? The emperor of ice cream means what?
Death.
Yeah. Remember the Hamlet allusion? You're only emperor for diet. Your worm is your only emperor for diet. This would be a diet of ice cream in the emperor of ice cream. But yeah. So two great facts of life are sexuality, which brings life into being, and death, which is what happens to the life thus brought into being. And the emperor of ice cream, then? Not so sure what we should think about that emperor, which tempts us into creating life that will die. If you've ever resented your parents for having had you, that's kind of what this poem is also about. That ice cream sounds great if you're living locally, but it then inevitably turns into a metaphor for the fact that it's a cold universe. Ice cream there, the iciness of the ice cream is what's really mattering at the end of the poem. The only emperor is the emperor of ice cream. So yeah, a cold universe. So not really that happy a poem. Stevens was really good at misleading titles. And this is an example of that. Look at the next poem. Okay, I'm just going to say one quick thing about the next poem, and then I want us to look at the section of a poem right after it. So the next poem, one of his most famous poems, is The Snowman. And remember the pathetic fallacy. What's the pathetic fallacy?
It's like raging fire.
Yeah, it is ascribing to inanimate objects, animate intentions, feelings, desires, actions, and so on. What's a great distinction in philosophy between actions and
intentions?
No, that's one great distinction. Actions and events. Mm-hmm. So an action is something that's intended. An event is just something that happens. So the it is. Sorry? No, that's Davidson. That's explicitly
only,
Davidson.
Only if you're Davidson.
Sorry?
Only if you're Davidson.
Only if you're Davidson. No. The idea is that events are just things that you can describe from the outside, and you don't have to say that someone turned on the light. That's an action. The switch flipping up, that's an event. So at any rate, the pathetic fallacy is kind of the difference between actions and events. An action is something that an animate being does. An event is something that happens whether there's an animate being there or not. So if a boulder falls in a desert, does it make a sound? Maybe, maybe not, but it definitely falls. If it falls, it falls. That's an event. So this is a poem about the pathetic fallacy, The Snowman. So, snowman, metaphor, maybe. Would you want to give the snowman intentions, use the pathetic fallacy about a snowman? Or is a snowman just snow? So, if you say, look at that snowman, you know, look at that Stephen King snowman over there, what does it want from me? That would be the pathetic fallacy, right? Because just spheres of snow piled on each other. So here's a poem called The Snowman. another poem about cold by Stevens. One must have a mind of winter to regard the frost and the boughs of the pine trees crusted with snow. So this poem is a single sentence. And we haven't gotten to what will happen if you have a mind of winter. So just so you know, that's the structure of the poem. It's one must have a mind of winter to do X without doing Y. That's the structure of this sentence. It's not you need a mind of winter to look at the frost and the boughs of the pine trees crusted with snow. Anyone can do that. But to do that without something else happening. So just that's where the other shoe is going to fall here. One must have a mind of winter to regard the frost and the boughs of the pine trees crusted with snow, and one must have been cold a long time to behold the junipers shagged with ice, to behold none of that giving each other looks, you two. To behold the junipers shagged with ice, the spruces rough in the distant glitter of the January sun. So you have to have a mind of winter to regard the frost in the boughs of the pine trees crusted with snow. You have to have been cold a long time to behold the junipers shagged with ice, the spruces rough in the distant glitter of the January snow. You need to have a mind of winter and have been cold a long time to do this and not to think of any misery in the sound of the wind. So if you think of misery in the sound of the wind, what are you engaging in? The pathetic fallacy. It's not a miserable wind, it's just wind. So you have to have been cold a long time. You have to have a mind of winter to look at these things and not think of misery, not to think of any misery in the sound of the wind, in the sound of a few leaves, which is the sound of the land, full of the same wind that is blowing in the same bare place for the listener who listens in the snow, and nothing himself. Because if you have a mind of winter and have been cold a long time, then the best metaphor for you is you're the snowman. And nothing himself beholds nothing that is not there. So doesn't engage in the pathetic fallacy. Doesn't see anything that is not there. Misery in the sound of the wind. For the listener who listens in the snow and nothing himself beholds nothing that is not there and the nothing that is. So, another poem that sounds like, yee, ice cream and snowmen. Yay, poems about ice cream, poems about snowmen. That'll be fun. Well, not so much. Ice cream, cold for Stevens. Snowman, cold. And this is about stripping away, you could say, hopefulness. This is not Stevens in a great mood. Either of these poems. This is Stevens in a sense of the nothingness of human life. So you behold nothing that is not there. You only see what's literally true. You don't engage in the pathetic fallacy. And if you only see what's literally true, well, what is there? Nothing. So you behold nothing that is not there and the nothing that is. Now that's too quick a reading of the poem and we won't go further into it, but it is a poem about how you can't get rid of the pathetic fallacy and that the mind can even face up to this kind of cold, this kind of apparent emptiness. So that is what Stevens is doing, just to say this without going through it, but just to say this, what Stevens is doing is saying that even if you strip everything away that can be stripped away, there's still something there. The mind of winter. The ability to behold, to see truth. And that is something. The mind of winter, you could say, is the exact opposite of the pathetic fallacy, because winter has no mind. And yet, he's saying you can have a mind of winter if you have been cold enough for long enough. Okay, let's quickly look at, this is the third stanza from his great late poem. It's in 10 stanzas, but we're only looking at this stanza, called The Auroras of Autumn, which is about seeing the northern lights. One night he saw the northern lights and he was blown away. He couldn't believe what he was seeing. And then he starts meditating and reflecting on the northern lights. And so he says, farewell to an idea. Again, think of having a mind of winter. That's like saying farewell to an idea. Farewell to an idea. And then here's the idea that he has to say farewell to. He says something amazing. The mother's face, the purpose of the poem, fills the room. So here is Stevens, I think he's around 70 when he writes this, saying, well, where does poetry come from, at least for me? Thinking of my mother's face. That's the purpose of the poem. The mother's face, the purpose of the poem, fills the room. They are together here, and it is warm. So he's a little child with his mother. They are together here, and it is warm, with none of the prescience of oncoming dreams. No fear, no sense that terrible dreams are about to come. It is evening. The house is evening, half dissolved. Only the half they can never possess remains. So we could talk about that line, but let's just keep going. Still starred. It is the mother they possess who gives transparency to their present peace. She makes that gentler that can gentle be. So just this memory of his mother from his childhood. And yet, she too is dissolved. She is destroyed. She gives transparency, but she has grown old. And then this amazing line. The necklace is a carving, not a kiss. The soft hands are a motion, not a touch. Okay, just that one line. The necklace is a carving, not a kiss. What does that mean? You can bring in the pathetic fallacy or not, as you like. But why would he say that? The necklace is a carving, not a kiss.
I'm just like thinking of a necklace maybe he has. Maybe it's from his mother and it's around his neck and he's sort of removing all the love that might be within that necklace, like the feeling of his mother's kiss.
Uh-huh.
He's removing that from the necklace. It's just a carved necklace. It's just an object. It doesn't mean anything anymore.
Okay. Does he want it to mean something more?
He might, but in this line, he's sort of denying himself that.
Yeah, she's dead.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so any other readings of the necklace as a carving, not a kiss?
It's permanent and it's painful. It's not something pleasant and passing.
Okay, good. The soft hands are emotion, not a touch. Something similar. What's the visual image that might cause him to say that? Massimo gave one possibility. Yeah.
Maybe like a necklace that the corpse is wearing, like on the mother.
Ooh. Okay, so her horny feet protruding. Okay, I think, notice first of all that he's saying there's no metaphor there. The metaphor would be the necklace is a kiss. No metaphor there. Okay, so just try this on for size. The visual memory he has is her leaning over to kiss him goodnight. And the visual memory he has is that as she does that, her necklace is hanging from her head, from her neck as she leans forward. And it's a beautiful memory of that kiss when he was a young child. But now, no, it's no longer the metaphor for the kiss that she gave him, the image that he had. It's a carving. The soft hands are a motion, not a touch. She's not touching him. Just look at one more line, the second to last line of the last stanza. To the mother, she falls asleep, and as they say good night, and then this amazing line, upstairs, the windows will be lighted, not the rooms. So again, everything has become a visual image. He's thinking of the house that he lived in, and he's seeing it from outside. And he sees the windows where he, as a child, was being kissed by his mother, whose warm hands were touching him and whose necklace was dangling down as she kissed him. But now from outside, amazing, the windows will be lighted, not the rooms. All he sees is the light in the windows. But behind the windows is nothing. There are no rooms there. It's not the light is coming from something preserved inside that building. It's not. So the windows will be lighted, not the rooms. So it's a very sad moment in this poem. The poem doesn't end sadly. The auroras do something for him. Stevens in his poetry, something we haven't talked about much in this class, but we have in talking about Mont Blanc, is that poems are often a way to get through a hard time in the course of the poem, to think your way out of the thing that the poem is responding to. Some crisis. The universe is overwhelming me. So I write Mont Blanc. Here, the auroras of autumn, the northern lights are overwhelmingly, and they remind me that my mother is dead. So I think my way through that in this poem, through this poem. And I do it through metaphors and through, in a sense, justifying the untruths of metaphors and saying the very fact that I can do that, metaphor itself is saving. Metaphors may all be false, but it's true that we can use metaphors. And that's something that Stevens is frequently doing. Okay, here are your quizzes. See you all on Tuesday.